Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Joining us, the host of Face the Nation, Margaret Brennan. Margaret, I sort of thought that regardless of the president's public stand on masking, that in private, he was probably wearing it all the time because the last thing you'd want would be what has happened now.
This is incredible. This is tanking global markets. This is sending a message of vulnerability to the rest of the world, to our adversaries, that the most protected man in the world with access to the very best health care and regular testing multiple times a day remains vulnerable to a virus that the United States government has no control over, even 7 months into a pandemic that has hit our shores and devastated large parts of this country. The question is, how ill does the president become? Is he one of the 40% of those who test positive, who remain asymptomatic, or does he become ill because he is in that risk group? We're watching this very carefully, given his age and given his weight.
Yeah, so he is asymptomatic at this point.
We don't know. All of this is being disclosed piecemeal after reporters first broke the news that one of his very closest aides, Hope Hicks, tested positive. This was not something the White House came out in a uniform way and in a message of transparency walked us through the details. All of us are doing the kind of contact tracing that doctors may be doing to figure out who the president came in contact with and when.
So, but he tweeted it. I mean, he sent out a tweet.
At 1 a.m., yes. News First was starting to be asked about because Hope Hicks, one of his closest aides, it was reported first by Bloomberg, had tested positive. On Wednesday morning, she tested negative. She was on Air Force One with the president. Other aides developed symptoms, then was tested later in the day. And we know, obviously, she came in contact as the president went on television and said late last night on Sean Hannity that he was going through tests because of his exposure to Hope Hicks. So it wasn't until the middle of the night that the president sent out that tweet. But in terms of how he's feeling, his medical records, the kind of details, all we know is a letter from the White House doctor that says he was informed, the doctor, that the president had tested positive and is monitoring.
And we don't know what the treatment's going to be.
We don't know yet. We do know that the health treatments have vastly improved in this country as doctors have seen more and more cases. So the chances of survival are higher. What we also don't know is what the long-term effects of COVID-19 are. As we've talked with Dr. Scott Gottlieb on the program about in the past, there are a number of heart problems, vascular issues that often persist after somebody recovers.
I'm still stunned because he's a germaphobe, for crying out loud.
He is.
Oh, wow. All right. So the atmosphere in D.C. now, I'm hearing all sorts of speculation. I mean, I even heard somebody speculating that they might delay the confirmation hearings on Judge Barrett. What do you know about that, Amy?
Well, this is part of that contact tracing that's being done to figure out who on Capitol Hill may have come into contact with those who came into contact with the president or with the president himself. Remember, look at the age group of so many of the top leaders on Capitol Hill. That puts them in that vulnerable category. There isn't a uniform testing regimen on Capitol Hill. You know, some sessions are held in person, some are still held remote. So there are a lot of logistical questions of, you know, what happens with Amy Coney Barrett's hearings that were supposed to begin as soon as the week of October 12th. So we just don't know yet what the schedule will be. We don't know if the presidential debate that was scheduled for October 15th will still happen. That may depend on how healthy the president feels. October 7th is the vice presidential debate. At this point, it looks like it's still on the calendar, and that will be scrutinized because it's a reminder that the people who are in that secondary spot may have to become primary.
Yeah, I'll go with the age of these candidates. I think that was always on the table, right? And
yes.
Pence has tested negative, so far
that's right.
So good.
That's right.
So in terms of what the vibe is in Washington, D.C., and not to be callous, but the effect on his constituents, his core supporters who are sort of with him on this, you know, defying the virus thing, is this a sobering moment for them?
We will have to see what the impact is on the campaign trail. Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of the UK, when he became ill, so ill, in fact, he had to be hospitalized at one point, there was kind of a rally around the flag moment in the UK when that happened. Is that what happens here? Does the president remain asymptomatic and say, this is no big deal after all, that this reaffirms his you know, messaging that it is not the dire risk that health officials have warned it can be, or that we saw it was, particularly in hot spots in the this country in the spring. We just don't know yet. But I think the takeaway that is clear is that even with access to regular testing, that doesn't make you invulnerable. You need to take those prophylactic measures of mask wearing and contact trace, keep your distance from people. It just shows us that 7 months into this pandemic, this country doesn't have control over it.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the rest of the White House staff, have they been taking this seriously? I mean, what do you notice around Washington, you know, with your contacts at the White House? Do the other personnel there mask up or not?
Quite often they do not.
Really?
There is regular testing of those who come into contact, physical contact with the president. And there has been this sort of perception that shows that there is a protection there. But that doesn't necessarily, as we saw with Hope Hicks, she tested negative Wednesday morning.
Yeah.
Wednesday evening, she had symptoms. So in those hours, what happened? We also know sometimes testing, there is a percentage error there, particularly with these rapid tests that are used and relied on at the White House. There are a lot of questions that remain unanswered. But expect the unexpected in 2020. That is the one people refer frequently to, the October surprise. There are a few things that we know are happening. We know the Constitution requires that the election is held on that first Tuesday in November. We know the Constitution requires January 20th at noon that there be a transfer of power, whether that is to a second Trump administration or Biden administration, that remains to be seen.
I'm buying a telescope and watching for the asteroid myself. Margaret Brennan, the host of Face the Nation. Thanks, Margaret.
Okay.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
So let's all take a moment to remember that it's Friday, and on Fridays, our resident historian, Felix Pinnell, joins us for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. And this week, it's well known that Point Roberts and other border towns in western Washington are suffering with the pandemic closure, but what about our state's easternmost border crossing, Felix?
Yeah, good thing you have me to fill in some time on a slow news day, Dave.
yes, that's right.
So that easternmost crossing is just north of the town of Medellin Falls in the far northeastern corner of the state, way up there in Ponderay County. And no, it's not pronounced Penned Oriole. The Medellin name dates to the mid-19th century when miners believed that the entire district was covered with minerals. That's according to historian Edmund Meany. The town of Medellin Falls was actually founded in 1910. The minerals around there included gold, silver, lead, and zinc. Now, the border closure to non-essential travel began back on March 21st. It's been extended a few times. Currently expires on October 21st. Not really a stretch to think it might be extended again. Talk about more about that in a second. The eponymous 19-foot-high falls are still there in the Ponderay River just north of town, but they're mostly underwater. They went away in 1967 when Seattle City Light built the Boundary Dam on the river. And they occasionally reappear when they do a drawdown, but they're kind of a thing of the past now. Now, the International Border Crossing is about 10 miles north of town. It's in this really cool building built in the early 1930s. It's called a classic northern type colonial revival style. Apparently, these were all along the border in different parts of the country 90 years ago. And it's still there. It's on the National Register of Historic Places. Now, about that closure, I checked in with Kimberly Petrich at the Farmhouse Cafe. She said since the closure, business has been terrible. They're used to having lots of Canadian customers. Summer was slow. Hunting season's right around the corner. It's not looking much better. And she says business is way down at the quilt shop next door, which functions as kind of a package depot for Canadians. Mm-hmm. Very much like what's going on at these other Western Washington crossings, but you don't hear much about it. Though times are tough there, she says they'll get through. If you ever stop there at the Farmhouse Cafe, biscuits and gravy are the big hit. Lots of homemade pastry and pies. One more thing about Medellin Falls. You might remember 25 years ago there was this post-apocalyptic movie with Kevin Costner called Waterworld.
Oh, yes.
That was filmed near there, near the Boundary Dam and everything. So
really?
If you're not getting enough post-apocalyptic stuff in your day-to-day life,
yeah, that's what we need.
Find Waterworld somewhere online and watch that and celebrate Medellin Falls and that wonderful part of northeastern Washington.
You buried the lead. Medellin Falls, where Waterworld was filmed.
The whole post-apocalyptic thing I'm a little weary of right now, Dave.
Yeah, really? What else can happen, Felix? What else can happen?
Hey, stay tuned to Cairo and you'll hear about it here first. That's all I know.
That's right. Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. We're all home today. There is a very short list of topics for us to discuss besides the president's COVID test, and one of them is Boeing. We have shock and concern and disappointment and feelings of betrayal among state and local leaders. Business owners and workers are devastated by Boeing's decision to pull production of the 787 Dreamliner in Everett out of state. The report from Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
There was no way to sugarcoat it.
Great disappointment and frustration.
The impact of losing the 787 line here in Everett will be deeply felt throughout our community.
Boeing delivered a crushing blow to the state and regional aerospace industry yesterday, announcing it would consolidate production of the 787 Dreamliner at its South Carolina plant. From the workers on the line,
I think 787 was always destined to move to South Carolina. They were going to replace that line with the new aircraft. Now with the COVID situation, that's the million-dollar question. With the union control or lack of control with Boeing now, I think that it's a sticky situation.
To contractors.
And losing the biggest player here. I mean, they're not leaving, but the fact that they can just like, okay, we're going to go somewhere else for cheaper is unsettling.
The hundreds of supply chain businesses in the state, including some 200 just in Everett, and the ripple effect that goes far beyond that to local restaurants and bars already struggling due to the pandemic.
It's definitely going to affect the business that we have. I mean, we rely on our mornings, our lunches, and our dinners, people that go to and come from Boeing. So it's definitely going to impact us as a restaurant and as servers. And it's going to take a toll on us for sure because we rely on the Boeing employees a lot, you know, for our income. So it's going to be tough.
So a very somber scene across Everett and Snohomish County after the announcement. Still, Snohomish County Executive Dave Summers understood and looked toward the future.
I feel no sense of betrayal.
This is always the rumor. Boeing's leaving Everett. Boeing's leaving Snohomish County. And Boeing is not leaving Everett and Snohomish County. And we are devastated to hear that this line is leaving. But we remain the largest manufacturing plant in the world. We have the largest number of aerospace jobs here in Everett. And we will work to grow them.
Everett Mayor Cassie Franklin's take. But she, too, expressed understanding for Boeing and the tough spot that it was in making this decision, while also expressing confidence in the city and the state's long relationship with Boeing. But just like everywhere else, Snohomish County and Everett are dealing with major economic issues due to the pandemic, and this is just another big hit. Governor Inslee had a very different tone on Boeing's decision, which he called an insult to the hardworking team at the Everett plant.
But today's news does not instill confidence regarding Boeing's similar decisions going forward in the future of aerospace in our state. And I just want to make clear that people know about our discussions with the Boeing company.
One of the main problems Inslee has with this Boeing decision.
In our discussions, which were several, including my staff and myself personally, the Boeing company never asked or suggested to the state of Washington anything that we could do to assure continued production of this airplane.
And that, he says, is unacceptable after the state has consistently delivered a skilled and trained workforce and a massive set of tax breaks that have saved Boeing hundreds of millions of dollars a year for years.
Simply put, we did everything we could to keep this production here. And what we know is that the dynamics of our partnership with the Boeing company, to some degree, has changed. And we have a fundamental obligation to our taxpayers to consider that.
Governor Inslee and Hannah Scott. The eyes of the world on Washington, D.C. Let's go there. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold joins us live from the Washington Post. This was not something I thought would happen. I thought, I mean, don't laugh. The president's a germaphobe, and I figured, okay, you're doing this in public because that's the message you want to send to your supporters. You're defiant. But in private, you know, knowing how important it is to be healthy as president, you would wear the mask. But apparently not. He was living the lifestyle. And so what about the rest of the people at the White House? Barron Trump is okay?
Yes, I think they said today that Barron Trump and Mike Pence, the second lady, Karen Pence, they are all tested negative. The positive tests have been Trump, First Lady Melania Trump, the RNC chairwoman, Ronna Romney McDaniel, and Hope Hicks, the White House staffer.
What about, Biden gets a test every day, too. So far, we know he's fine. What about Chris Wallace?
I have not heard about Wallace. We've been told that Biden is getting tested this morning, but have not heard anything about the results yet. But it sort of depends on when Trump was contagious. They were far apart in Cleveland, but they were on the same stage for a long time.
Right. The vice president tested negative today, right? And I saw some speculation that this might delay the confirmation hearings for Amy Coney Barrett. You know anything about that?
Well, I've definitely seen that too. I mean, Coney Barrett had contact with the president on Saturday. And, you know, if she decides to quarantine, that might mean, you know, they were running on a pretty tight timeline anyway. If she decides to quarantine, that could push it all back, and it could mean the vote would come after the election. Congress, members of Congress also have had a lot of contact with Trump. But in Congress, it's really sort of up to you. Congress is kind of the Wild West on COVID. So if members want to quarantine, they can, but they don't have to. And I imagine many Republicans will not.
Yeah. I was talking to Margaret Brennan this morning, just asking her what is the custom at the White House. And she says that most of the staff just goes around unmasked. So I guess this was predictable.
Well, you know, they get tests, but it sounds like, I mean, these tests are not foolproof, obviously, because, you know, and they do go around unmasked. I mean, the description of the Trump's debate prep, A, it's amazing that he had a debate prep anyway, because it didn't seem like he actually had any sort of plan for the debate. But it was Trump, Chris Christie, Rudy Giuliani, Hope Hicks, and I think some other people in a small conference room for days at a time, unmasked in a little space. Wow. Why not do that outside? It's one thing to try to claim political credit by telling people that it's getting better, but to pretend like, as you said, in your own life that this disease doesn't exist and risk your own health, it's just amazing.
Yeah, I agree. So what are the parties doing to plan in case he is incapacitated in some way?
Well, I mean, it goes without saying, we've never had a situation like this in an American presidential election. Apparently, if a nominee dies before Election Day, the party can replace them. The question is, can the states print out ballots? And what about all the ballots where people have already cast votes? If Trump is incapacitated, I imagine that the election will just carry on. People will campaign in his stead, and he'll try to recover before Election Day. I'm saying if Biden gets sick, I don't see them either party replacing their candidate unless, God forbid, one of them were to die.
Yeah. So what's the atmosphere like there today?
I mean, I think everyone's just in shock. I mean, on the one hand, the Trumps, the whole family and Trump particularly have been courting this risk for so long. Not just Trump and his family have been doing events unmasked indoors with lots and lots of people packed together. The exact sort of thing you're not supposed to be doing. And I think maybe they just felt like they were invincible because they've been doing this for a long time and nothing bad had happened yet. So on the one hand, it's not that surprising. But on the other hand, it is surprising. I mean, this is the president of the United States has a potentially deadly and incurable virus. You know, we haven't had something like that in this country for years and years. And it's hard to know how people are going to react.
I think he's invincible, though. I mean, we know from the conversation with Bob Woodward that he was convinced that this virus was dangerous back in February.
I agree. And for a while, he did take precautions, as did the rest of his family. But as, you know, like a lot of people, you know, people let their guard down when nothing bad happened for months. You know, they took these risks and nothing happened. So they kept taking bigger risks. Trump, his whole approach to problems in his life has been denial, to try to convince other people that the problems, his debts, his business failures, whatever, didn't exist. And it's always been a question how much he believed of those denials, or did he understand, you know, the situation he was trying to prevent others from understanding. And it seems like in this case, they may have believed their own denials enough to expose themselves.
Yeah, always a dangerous thing. So how does this affect his supporters now? Is he now going to be modeling the very opposite of what he modeled before?
I mean, I hope it convinces people who believe COVID is a hoax or believe masks don't work. I hope it convinces some of those people that that's wrong and they should start protecting themselves just for their own health. You know, what does it mean for his political support? I think you'd have to know more about the course of the disease. You know, if he's like Bolsonaro in Brazil, who had a pretty mild case and got over it, it only reinforced Bolsonaro's denialism. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's not a big deal. Look at me. I got over it. I was fine. You know, if it causes, God forbid, any sort of serious medical complications, like what happened with Prime Minister Boris Johnson in the UK, you know, that could change, you know, people's perceptions of Trump. It could change Trump's own beliefs. I don't know. We're so close to the election, though. I feel like so many of the attitudes about him are kind of baked in. It may be hard for anything to change it, even the president's illness.
Well, it could work out that way. I mean, if he stays asymptomatic, he could also come out of this saying, "See, I told you so." And I mean, I had two relatives who had it, and it was described to me by my sister as a really horrible sinus infection, but she was able to get over it without hospitalization. I think she'd sure want to get it again, so it wasn't like she was asymptomatic. But I mean, that could potentially be the outcome here. He has no symptoms. He tests negative, and he says, "Yeah, so I got through it. What's the big deal?"
And that would be the worst outcome, I think, you know, if he said, if that's his message afterward, that would be the worst outcome for public health, because people would then be like, oh, you know, even more emboldened about, let's get it and get it over with. I hope he recovers asymptomatically. I hope he doesn't have any sort of illness. Apparently he's had mild symptoms today. Yeah. But if he, you know, however he recovers, I hope the message people don't take away from it is not, this isn't a big deal, I don't mind catching this disease.
Yeah. David Farenthold, live from the Washington Post. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Your daily dose of kindness now. It's brought to you by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. It's happened to a lot of us. You forget your wallet at home, and then when you go to pay for something, you have to turn around and go back, and it's a big inconvenience, sometimes an embarrassment too. But that's not what happened when a woman in Ohio forgot her wallet at a McDonald's drive-thru last month. Brittany Ree told her story to WLWT-TV. She says she was coming through at the end of a long day, hauling her 4 and 7-year-old kids home from soccer practice.
I tell the young man working the window, like, I totally forgot my purse at home. I'm so sorry. I got to cancel that entire order. And before I could say, I'll be right back, he was like, not a problem. He reaches out and grabs his wallet and just swipes his debit card. And I was like, what did you just do? I was like, no, I don't have anything with me. And he was like, no, it's fine, ma'am. I got it.
She drove back to the McDonald's later that night with her purse to pay back the teenager who had paid for her food. But Wyatt Jones wouldn't accept it and said the meal was on him. Wyatt's mom says her son didn't tell her about it when he came home because he didn't think it was a big deal.
It makes me even probably more proud of him because he's not seeking the limelight. He's not like, hey, look at me. You know, I did this great big good deed. And he's still like, you know, it's just something I would do anytime.
But Brittany did think it was a big deal. She posted on Facebook to tell people about his random act of kindness. She wrote, I just wanted his parents to know how kind and compassionate their son was tonight. He made this stressed out mama pause for a moment and realize this is exactly what we parents are trying to do. Raise great humans. Wyatt, do not let the world change your kind heart, for it's people like you that will change this world for the better.
The world's kind of scary right now, and it's very uncertain. And so stuff like when you hear about somebody being kind for no reason is, you know, unfortunately, it's not the norm all the time anymore.
Brittany didn't stop at that post, as usual. She heard that Wyatt was saving up to buy a car. So last week, she set up a GoFundMe. The campaign blew past its original goal of $5,000, and this morning has raised more than $32,000 for Wyatt. I'd say, based on the prices these days, that'll get him a nice new car.
I think so. So I'm home. Colleen's home. Chris is home. And G. Scott is home. So now everybody you're hearing this morning is at home, and G doesn't want to talk about the virus. He wants to talk about the Seahawks, and so do I.
Yeah.
So what are we, let's see, Miami's in this time?
Miami. Seahawks travel to Miami for a 10 o'clock game out there, and I'm more nervous about this game than I was any other ones, even including the Patriots, of course, and the Dallas Cowboys. Here's why. The Miami Dolphins, if you're thinking about it, the first thing probably came to your head was, yeah, they're supposed to win that game. See? Mm-hmm. Caught you. That's exactly why I'm nervous of this game. You got to think, when the Seahawks travel to Miami and play against this team, this Miami team is going to play the very best that they can because they know the Seahawks are coming to town. Even if some of those individuals, maybe it's not even, maybe they don't win the game, but a lot of these players, they want to put it on film. So when they have contracts coming up, or maybe they have a year left on their deal, playing against the Seahawks and playing very well against a good team looks good for them, looks good on their resume. So when the Seahawks travel out there, this is a game that even us fans are like, yeah, they're supposed to win that game. There's no way about it. They are supposed to win that. Well, they are an NFL team too. So I'm a little nervous that they're going to go out there and it could be a tough game. And if they were to win a game, if the Miami Dolphins were to win the game, what does that do to a really good team? What does that do to the psyche of a locker room? Sometimes we can look back in some seasons and we can say, yeah, remember the Seahawks lost this game and then they kind of lost a few more games? Or remember when the Seahawks won that game and then they rattled off 6 straight? Sometimes those things can linger. So I just want Seattle to go out to Miami, win that game, and come on home.
But they're pretty banged up. I mean, the injury list is long, and some pretty key players like Jamal Adams won't be playing. So, you know, I wonder about this one.
Yeah, and, you know, Colleen, I tried to escape from talking about the injuries the entire time. But
why?
Nope, Colleen, you would not let me. You said, but Cheetah, banged up. You're absolutely right, and they are extremely banged up considering that they are missing one of their best players on defense, number 33, Jamal Adams. He has been huge all season long. I call him the other captain on the field alongside Bobby Wagner. Missing him is going to be big. And right now, up front, when I mean by up front, the defensive line hasn't had the best pass rush, but they've done enough to kind of get things done. There were times, glimpses in that Dallas Cowboy games, and you guys saw it, and you're like, oh, this defense, I don't know. But they, of course, pull it off because Russell, being Russell, does what he does and be the hero at the end. But yes, Colleen, you're right. The injuries can add up for any NFL team. That's just kind of how it happens.
I see Miles Gaskin is on the Miami team. Why do I recognize his name?
Miles Gaskin, O'Day High School, University of Washington. He's a bad man. Yeah. He's a running back out there, also on their practice squad from Juanita High School, played at the University of Washington. Savan Ahmed, he is out there with the Miami Dolphins. So a little bit of Pacific Northwest love out there in Miami. I like to think that their weather is probably a little bit better than ours, but Miles Gaskin has been doing his thing. I think he ran the ball for about 20 times and about 60-something yards last week in the game in the win. The good news is about Miles is I think that he's really starting to get it a little bit. He's going to improve, and wouldn't be something if he has a breakout game against his hometown team, the Seattle Seahawks. I got to hit him up and ask him, how does it feel to get ready to play against the Seahawks? That's got to be something.
Yeah. All right, so let's see. Packers undefeated, just looking at the NFC. Bears still undefeated. Seahawks, of course. And let's see. That's it. Dolphins are 1-2, right?
Yeah, Dolphins are 1-2. And see, that's what I'm saying, guys. You know, those kind of games. Those are the games in the NFL. You just got to wonder. So, and you also ask yourself, like, look, Russell Wilson through three games has thrown the most touchdowns. Check this out. I'm going to break it down for you. Russell Wilson has thrown the most touchdowns through three games than any quarterback in NFL history, right? How did those games go? Were they blowouts? Wasn't it a nail-biter against Patriots?
Right.
Wasn't
it
a nail-biter against the Cowboys? Was it a kind of back
and forth?
Well, then
they're due for a blowout.
Okay, well, say that then. Well, and they're due for a blowout. You're right, guys. And also, they also need Russell Wilson to play out of this world. Imagine having to do radio every single day, and in order for you to do well, you have to do the best radio every single day. I like the fact that I do the best radio maybe once every 6 months. You know what I'm saying?
Jeez, come on.
I mean, every 6 months. But Russell, this dude waking up every single day like, yo, I got you.
He's only got to work once a week, you see.
I know. You have a radio show 5 days a week.
Right.
So
yeah.
G. Scott joins Ursula for one of those days this morning at noon.
See,
I don't even know what day it is. This morning at 9 until noon. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.